a bit of the groundwork to help you when you come to the second half of the program, which is you're going to be working with your mentors, and you're going to be hearing a lot more keynote speakers and so on. So it's just to help you so that you'll be able to understand more stuff that's going on. Okay, so last time we had talked a lot about the particle in the box, and we had learned a whole bunch of things about quantum mechanics. We had learned about quantization of energy. We had learned about standing waves representing what's going on inside the box, and in particular the square of those standing waves giving us a probability pattern of where we're going to find the particle, all kinds of stuff like that. So, in fact, you've already learned through that a great deal about quantum mechanics. And so now what we're going to do is we're going to take that intuitive sort of gut kind of feeling about what's going on for particles inside boxes or particles confined to spaces and sort of generalize. See if we can take that intuitive understanding and apply it to slightly different situations and see if we can learn something about those slightly different situations. Okay, so we'll talk a little bit about bound particles in general. Okay, so we'll consider different kinds of bound particles. Here's a really simple example of a bound particle. If I have a bowl like this, and I put a ball in that bowl, I start it from rest here and release it, what's it going to do? It's going to oscillate back and forth. Okay, so we're imagining we're in a gravitational field down like this. So it's just going to oscillate back and forth like this. And that particle is bound. Okay, it doesn't, as it's moving, it doesn't like all of a sudden like go away over here. Right? It's bound to this bowl. It's bound to some region along, we'll call this the x-axis here. So this is its horizontal motion, so it's projection down. As it's oscillating back and forth like this, the projection down onto the x-axis means it's vibrating back and forth along the x-axis. Okay, and we'll take this to be the vertical axis, y here. And we will give our bowl a special shape, a particular shape. Okay, we'll say that our bowl is quadratic in shape. So that means that y is what's kind of function of x? X squared. So y is proportional to x squared. So y is proportional to x squared. It's a quadratic shape. That's a special shape that will turn out to be particularly useful. Okay, and we will suppose that our ball has a mass m. And what else do we need? Okay, so suppose that we release it from rest at this point over here. So the amplitude of the vibration, as it goes back and forth, it will the furthest right it can go is plus a. It'll then pass through zero, and it will go all the way to minus a here. So the amplitude a of the vibration tells us the range over the x-axis, the projection down. Okay, so we got that. What else do we need? Okay, that's it. So let's think about energy. What's happening in this picture? In the context of energy. So what kinds of energy are involved in this motion? I heard this muddled mix of potential and kinetic. Okay, so excellent. So there's potential energy involved. In this case, what kind of potential energy? Gravitational potential energy. So suppose that the ball is over here, so its x position is just x. And correspondingly, its y, its height above the bottom of the bowl is y. So if its height above the bottom of the bowl is y, what is its gravitational potential energy? Mgy. So the mass is m, gravitational field is g, gravitational acceleration is g. So it's just mgy is its gravitational potential energy. Okay. Now, what we want is to understand what its gravitational potential energy is as a function of x. So we were just interested really in the projection on the x-axis as it goes back and forth. So how can we've got the gravitational potential energy written in terms of y. How would we write it in terms of x? Right. Okay, so because y is proportional to x squared, this y is basically an x squared. So it's some constant times x squared. Okay, so we will choose that constant to be 1/2 k. We'll call it 1/2 k, just for conventional purposes. Okay, so the potential energy is proportional to x squared. Okay, so when it's down here, what is its potential energy? 0 at the bottom. And then when it's up here, that potential energy grows as x squared because the height grows as x squared. Okay, and same thing on the left-hand side. If x is negative, x squared is still positive. Okay, so what about its kinetic energy? What's its kinetic energy? We're assuming that the ball is actually slipping. So there's no rotational kinetic energy associated with the ball. Good point, yeah. Okay, so that's right. Or the ball has zero moment of inertia. Yeah. Okay, so the kinetic energy is 1/2 mv². Which we can also write as p squared over 2m. If p is mv, we can write it that way. Okay? Now, it turns out that given this situation, given the mass m and the shape of the bowl, which is related to this constant k, okay, given these two parameters in the system here, we can determine what the frequency of the oscillation is back and forth. Okay? So the frequency of back and forth. So the frequency turns out to be 1 over 2 pi times the square root of k over m. Okay, so what is that saying? So just to get a rough feel for this, k is in the numerator because if I make the bowl steeper, if I make the bowl steeper, then I increase the value of k. Because y is proportional to x squared, and that proportionality constant involves k. So if I make k bigger, the bowl gets steeper, and it's going to oscillate back and forth more rapidly. If I make k smaller, then the bowl is more shallow, and it's going to go oscillate back and forth more slowly. Okay, and the mass is in the denominator, because the bigger I make the mass, the more sluggish the whole system will be. Yeah. We just said that y is proportional to x squared. In other words, y is equal to some constant k prime times x squared. And then we said mgk prime, we just called it a new constant, 1/2 k. So it's just for convention. It's convention so that this formula is simple. Okay. So the frequency is related to the shape of the bowl and the mass. Technically, this is not totally correct because the momentum here involves both an x component and a y component. And that formula applies exactly to this situation. If I have a mass of a body of mass m attached to a spring with spring constant k, and this thing is vibrating back and forth, then the frequency will be given by this. Okay? But this situation with the bowl is, I think, a little bit easier to understand where all this stuff comes from. And it's almost correct. Okay? So we'll just take it as correct. Okay, so we have two forms of energy, potential and kinetic, and we're ignoring any friction. So once we set this thing into motion, this thing will just oscillate back and forth forever. Okay? So the total energy is the sum of kinetic plus potential. Okay, so kinetic so it looks like that. Does this kinetic energy change with time? The total energy change with time? So energy is conserved, right? The total energy is conserved. So I start maybe with the bowl at the bottom and a ball at the bottom, and I give it a kick, and then forevermore I leave it alone. The kick that I've given it gives it some energy. Or I start it from rest up at some height. It starts out with some gravitational potential energy. I release it. That energy is always in the system. Okay, so this is constant. Energy is conserved. What about the kinetic energy? Is it constant? What's the kinetic energy here? What's the kinetic energy here? Max, and so on. Okay, so the kinetic energy changes with time, and the potential energy also changes with time. Okay, so the potential energy, what's the potential energy here? What's the potential energy here? Maximum. Okay, so that's because the momentum. So the kinetic energy changes with time because the momentum changes with time. the velocity changes with time. Here the velocity is momentarily zero. When it flies up like this, it slows down, momentarily comes to rest, and then it picks up speed again and so on. And it's maximum here because it's moving fastest when it's passing through the bottom of the bowl. The potential energy, also the height y, or the position x, is a function of time. So the potential energy also depends upon time, because the position depends upon time. Okay, so we have that. And just to get a feel for how these are changing, I just want you to really see this sort of graphically. At any instant of time, we might have a situation that looks like this. The kinetic energy is, say, large. This is kinetic energy. And the potential energy might be small. Okay, so this would describe a situation where the kinetic energy is fairly large, so it's close to the bottom of the bowl. Maybe it's over here. It's whipping pretty fast. And the potential energy is not quite zero yet, hasn't reached the bottom of the bowl, but it's close to the bottom of the bowl. The potential energy is small. As time goes on, what's going to happen? Will the kinetic energy increase or decrease? Kinetic energy will increase. Right. Okay, so the kinetic energy will increase until it gets to maximum value. Potential energy will decrease to zero, and so on. So basically, these potential energy and kinetic energy little bar graphs, they just oscillate up and down like this as time goes on, such that the sum of those two bar graphs always amounts to the same total energy. Okay? So these guys, if that guy's going down, this guy's going up, and vice versa, such that the sum is constant. Energy is conserved. Okay? Yeah.
Overall energy is constant, they have to be the same.
Excellent point. Yeah, so what you're saying is, so this guy, say, is going up and this guy's going down, and then eventually all of the energy is in kinetic. So this level must represent the total energy here. And then when this guy goes to zero, well, the potential energy must contain, or the potential must hold all of the energy. And so it's that way. So the maximum values are the same. That's right. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about these turning, about something called the turning points. Okay, so the turning points are here and here. Okay, so this guy is oscillating back and forth, and at this point it slows down, momentarily at rest, and then turns around and starts its oscillation to the left. Okay, so those are the turning points. So at these turning points, what is the momentum? Zero. So it's momentarily at rest. What is the value of x? Plus or minus a. Okay, so we just concluded here that the total energy is constant. That means it doesn't change with time. We can evaluate what that total energy is by looking at the system at any instant of time. A really convenient time to look at it is at these turning points. So at these turning points, we can evaluate what that E is. So E is kinetic, p squared over 2m, plus 1/2 kx squared. At a turning point, p is just 0. And at a turning point, x is just plus or minus a. X squared is just a squared. So it tells us that E is just 0 plus 1/2 kA squared. So it tells us a relationship between the total energy of that ball in the bowl and the amplitude of its vibration back and forth. Okay? So now the important thing is here, we can turn this around and solve for a, given energy. So what is a? So yeah, we could put plus or minus here, and it's just saying that the amplitude of vibration could be plus or minus this number. Okay, but we're assuming that a is positive, and we have a and minus a. So we're putting that minus sign in here by hand. Okay. So it tells us the relationship between the amplitude and the energy. Okay. So in the previous, This situation we're going to see is very similar to the particle in the box. The particle in the box was bound between 0 and L. Along the x-axis, it couldn't go to the left of 0. It couldn't go to the right of L. So it was bound in this range. Okay. For the ball in the bowl, it's also bound. It's bound, but it's bound depends upon the energy. Okay, so if we give it a little bit of energy, that means we started out over there, it oscillates back and forth like this, right? The amplitude of the oscillation is not very much. So it's bound between here and here. If the energy that we've given it is small, the amplitude is small and it's bound in a small region. If we give it more energy, if we started up here, then this is bigger, the amplitude is bigger, it's still bound, but the range over which it's bound has now grown bigger. Okay, so that's one interesting difference so far. Okay, but I want to point out that the situation is very similar. So that's one difference, but there's an important similarity here, just a general similarity between the two. Okay, so it's qualitatively similar in the following sense. Suppose that I started, let's say, qualitatively similar. Qualitatively similar to our mass in the box, bouncing back and forth. Okay, so how is that? Well, here we've got our situation, which is the ball rolling back and forth in this bowl. Now, suppose that I take the shape of that bowl and I distort it a little bit. Okay, so what I'm going to do, the distortion is I'm going to make the bottom of the bowl a little bit flatter. Okay, so it's going to come like this, down like this, and then it's going to be flat like this, and then it's going to come like this. Okay, so this shape here is qualitatively similar to this. Okay, it basically is a bowl-type shape. Okay, but now you'll notice that if I start the ball up here, it rolls down very fast over here. But then when it comes over here, does its velocity change? It's constant, right? There's no friction here. Okay, so whatever velocity it has starting here, it just moves with it, just drifts across the bottom with a constant velocity. Okay, and then it comes up to here, and it goes quickly up to that same height that it had before, and then quickly back down, and then it drifts across here. And then dunk, dunk. Dung, 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 dung. Okay, so it's like that. So that's very similar to this. It just drifts with a constant velocity, and then boom, boom. Okay, so if we wanted to make it exactly like this, what we would do is we would really bend the shape. This would be basically vertical like this, and like this. Okay, so now it just drifts with a constant velocity, and it goes like that. Okay, so basically they're the same situation. Okay, qualitatively the same. They just differ a little bit in detail. Okay, so the fact that they're basically the same means that everything that we learned about the quantum behavior of a particle inside a box like that, we can apply to the particle rolling around in this bowl. Okay, so let's see. So let's review what it is we've learned. So in other words, based upon just what we've seen so far, we should be able to say a whole bunch of things about the quantum behavior. So let's look first at the energy. Okay, so that's the zero energy. Okay, so the first question I have is, what is the lowest energy? What is the least amount of energy this ball could have? What is the least amount of energy classically? And how would I describe the motion of the ball? It's just sitting there at the bottom. That's zero energy. Okay, if that were the case, what is its position? What is our uncertainty in a position? Okay, so we know it's exactly at x equals 0. So there's no uncertainty. Delta x is 0. What is its momentum? Momentum is 0, and it's permanently 0. It's exactly 0. So there's no uncertainty in momentum. Is that allowed in the quantum world? Okay, so by Heisenberg uncertainty, we can't have this situation. So it has to be doing some kind of motion. Okay, so what is the lowest energy here? Is it 0? It's E0. It's the zero point energy. Okay, so there's going to be a zero point energy. right? What else? Suppose it has this zero-point energy. Can I give it any amount of energy? Suppose I come here, it's got this zero-point energy, and it's doing this weird quantum thing at the bottom, and then I come here and I flick it with my finger. Can I give it any amount of energy? Okay, discrete. So the energy is going to be quantized. Okay. Now, when we were doing the particle in the bowl, particle in the box, what we found is these discrete energy levels, the first one was 4 times E0, the next one was 9 times E0, and so on. So the spacing between those levels was not the same. It turns out that because of the quadratic shape of the bowl, that's why we made that special choice, turns out that with the quadratic shape of bowl, the spacing between these energy levels, these allowed energy levels, is uniform, is evenly spaced. Okay? So all of these are h, Planck's constant, times the natural frequency, that frequency there, the square root of k over 2m divided by 2 pi. So if I give you a bowl with a certain shape that's described by k and a mass of ball m, then the amount of energy that I can give it, the spacings, is just h times that frequency. Okay, so if you work through the details of the mathematics, if you write down Schrodinger's equation and you solve this equation, et cetera, you will find that those are the energy spacings. And you will find that E0, the distance from 0 to E0, that zero-point energy, is 1/2 of that spacing HF. Okay, so those are just details. They're important details, but they're just details. Okay, so we already know that something like this is going to emerge. Okay, so we've got that. What can we say about say, psi 0? What's psi 0 going to look like? So suppose that the particle in the bowl is in this zero-point motion. What can I say about its wave function? What's it sort of going to look like? So two nodes here and here. And then what? Okay, so one bump like that. So what kind of a wave are we talking about, first of all? It's a standing wave, right? So it's a standing wave, and so it's going to be something which oscillates back and forth like that, up and down like that. Okay? Now one difference is, first of all, we don't have nodes like this. Okay? And that's because here, what we're saying is, well, okay, let me look back to this one. What we're saying is there's for sure zero probability that the particle is outside the bowl. So whatever is happening inside here, whatever this wave is, it must go to zero right there, go exactly to zero right there. Okay? That's in this situation when the sides of the bowl are really, really steep. Okay, when we relax the sides of the bowl, okay, so now we're here. Okay. It turns out that, so classically, it is true that it will oscillate back and forth, and it will exactly stop here and come back, and then exactly stop here and come back. And so it's never outside here. But quantum mechanically, it turns out that it actually can go a little bit higher than this. There can be fluctuations a little bit higher, and then it can come back down. So it can actually go outside of that. And so actually, and this is something called quantum mechanical tunneling. Maybe you've heard of this word, tunneling. Okay, so this is what's actually happening. So I'm not sure we're going to have time to talk about that in detail, but I'll just say what it does is it changes the shape just a little bit. It makes it look more like that. It just smoothly goes to zero instead of abruptly. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, if you were to do it, You could like essentially put the particle wherever along the bowl you want. So at different amplitudes.
Right.
So how does that work out?
Okay, so what you're saying is I can place the particle anywhere, and so therefore I can give it any energy.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. the fact is you can't really place it anywhere. There's a sense in which you can't place it just anywhere.
Yeah.
would happen then? So what would happen then is, yeah, okay, so that's a good question. So let's see. What would happen then is it would somehow get rid of that energy. So basically what you're saying is we're in this bowl here like this, and we place it sort of anywhere in some place so that the energy is blah blah, right? And then we're really talking about waves. Okay, so there are sort of waves like this, and so these, so we're starting with a wave function which is localized here. Okay, so we know the particle is basically here because we placed it here. But then as time goes on, this wave is going to go back and forth. It's going to move this way, and it's going to spread out as it moves this way, and then start oscillating back and forth until eventually we set up a standing wave. And so in that whole complicated process, there's going to be, it's going to get rid of some of its energy. Yeah. Okay, so we've got this. This is psi 0. And then we say, okay, well, what's the probability? How do I go from a wave, from a standing wave, to a probability pattern? I square that. Okay, so qualitatively, I'm going to have something which looks like this. Okay, so what we know is when the particle has this energy, we know that it's not definitely at zero. It's basically zero plus or minus here. I might find it over there. One time, I might find it over there, that sort of thing. Okay. So qualitatively, we've already said a great deal. Okay, let's look at the next level, this one here. What's psi 1 going to look like?
One crest, one.
Right, so a whole wavelength, one crest, one trough. So for the particle in the box, it looked like this. But now we're going to smooth out this edge a little bit. And we're going to smooth out this guy a little bit. Because the bowl is not so steep shape, and so it's going to be a standing wave like this. So roughly where it ends here, is it going to be the same or wider or narrower? What is the sort of width? The width of this standing wave is about like this. If I give it more energy, will the width of the standing wave increase or decrease, or stay the same? Increase, why? That's right. So it has more energy. So classically, the amplitude of vibration is larger. And quantum mechanically, that means that its wave function will spread out. Okay. And similarly for the other ones. Okay. So basically, the picture looks something like this. Okay. Where if we're in a high energy state like this, then we have many many oscillations like this. Okay. And it's smoothed out a little bit at the edge like that. Okay, and it's wider. Okay, so we've said a tremendous amount about this already. And P1 is going to look like this. If I square that and that, I'm going to get two lumps. If I square all of these guys, some are positive now, some are negative, and I'm going to get all positive lumps. Like that. Yeah. Okay.
So if we know its position and we know how much total energy it has, then according to that formula, we can also find its momentum, and then we know its momentum and its position.
Okay, but when we measure its position and find out its position, then in the process of measuring that position, we will give it a random kick of momentum so that we no longer know what its momentum is at the same time. The reason is
at that position, it can only have a certain amount of momentum, because otherwise it doesn't have one of those energy levels.
Okay, but let's look at it this way. I've got this thing in the bowl, right? And then this thing is doing something quantum mechanically, and I would like to measure the position of that thing. How do I do that? Remember that everything that you do, every kind of measurement you do, you can't do measurements in the abstract. Everything that you do is you have to use the stuff that's around you. You have to use stuff in the universe to do this.
Okay, well, what if we use
how am I going to measure?
We use a photon that isn't.
Okay, let's use a photon.
But what if it's not at the right frequency?
Okay. That's okay. So let's use a super high energy photon, because what we want is short wavelength to measure exactly the position. Okay? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that photon and I'm going to shine a photon at that particle. and that photon is going to scatter from that particle. If that photon doesn't scatter, we don't see anything. So that photon will scatter from that particle, and then we will look at that photon with a microscope, and we will look at exactly where it came from and so on, and we will then determine quite accurately the position of the particle. But then in that process, we will give this thing some energy.
But I thought it couldn't absorb energy except in quantities on that scale. So what if that photon isn't part of that? Like it's in between?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Well, here's one thing. Suppose that you're dealing with an atom. Okay, so with an atom, what we know is, and we talked about this last time, if we have an atom like this, and we have these energy levels for the atom, we know that if we have a photon coming in like this, if the photon doesn't have the right energy, then what it's going to do is this photon is just going to pass through. It won't see the atom. Okay, but if it does have the right energy, then it will be absorbed. So let's see. So in this case, So maybe the photon would just pass through and not be deflected.
So you can only measure a certain frequency, right?
No, I don't think that's right. Let me think about that, and I will try to answer that this afternoon. Okay. So, right. So this is our qualitative picture that's emerged, right? So we understand a lot about this system. Okay. So we have this zero point energy, we have this spacing of energy, and I want to focus on this spacing of energy, because the fact is, there is something very, very deep in this. You will be surprised at how deep this is. So the energy levels are evenly spaced. Okay, so the difference from one energy level to the next is just Planck's constant times the natural frequency of oscillation. Does anyone recognize that formula? Does that formula ring a bell somehow? Energy of the wave, yeah.
Isn't that formula that Einstein discovered?
That's that energy that Einstein discovered about photons. Right. So Einstein's formula says E photon. The energy of a photon is just Planck's constant times the frequency of the photon, times the color of the photon, the wave, the frequency. Okay, so that looks quite similar. Okay. In fact, it is. It's the same thing. Okay. So let's look at this. So this is actually takes us to something called quantum field theory. So if you take quantum mechanics, the stuff that we're talking about here, which we know is based in a Newtonian universe. So all of the quantum mechanics we're talking about imagines a Newtonian space and a Newtonian time. If we take those quantum ideas and combine them with special relativity, so the fact that there's a speed limit in the universe, and we get time dilation and length contraction and all that stuff, relativity of simultaneity, if we combine those two ideas together, we get something called quantum field theory. Okay? And so what is that? So it's basically, first of all, field. So a good example of that is the electromagnetic field. So Maxwell's electromagnetic waves. Okay? That's an example of a field. And what we do is we quantize that field. So classically, light is an electromagnetic wave, electromagnetic field, electric and magnetic fields oscillating, you know, filling space and oscillating and doing all kinds of stuff. And when we apply quantum ideas to that, what do you think happens? Or what do you know happens? And then we get the idea of photons. So a photon is a purely quantum mechanical object. It just has no analog in the classical world. It's this quantum thing. Okay, so photons come from applying quantum mechanics to electromagnetism. Okay, so let's look at how this arises. So suppose that I have a box, and this box is a box made out of mirrors. Okay, and inside that box I have some light. These are perfect mirrors that don't absorb. Okay, and so this light is bouncing back and forth inside that box. Okay, so we think of light as a wave for a minute. In fact, for the next couple minutes, light is a wave, electromagnetic wave. So it's a wave bouncing back and forth inside a box. What's going to happen? I got a wave moving to the right. It bounces off the mirror. I got a wave moving to the left, standing wave. Okay, so what I'm going to get is standing waves. Okay, and I'm only going to get certain allowed standing waves, et cetera. So an electromagnetic wave, suppose we have one going to the right like this. So basically what it looks like is if I take a snapshot of that wave at any instant of time, it looks like this. In space, there's an electric field like this. That's E. And there's a magnetic field which is perpendicular to that, okay, which looks like this. Okay, like we drew yesterday. So there's a magnetic field B. So at any instant of time, if you take a snapshot of a light wave that's zipping by you like this, you're going to see this pattern of electric field going up and down. Here the electric field is large and positive, then it goes to zero, then it's large and negative, and so on. And the B is, and the magnetic field is perpendicular to that. Okay, and this whole thing, that whole pattern of waves that we've taken a snapshot of, moves to the right at the speed of light. Okay, and so that thing slams into that mirror. Electric field flips around, magnetic field not, and it comes back. And so then we add those two waves up, and we get a standing wave. So inside, we have this standing wave, which I'll just draw in a more simplified way as just this. So it's some kind of a standing wave. That's, say, zero at the ends. Okay? So you can imagine that there are lots of possible standing waves. We could have standing waves going this way, back and forth. And we could have standing waves going this way, standing waves going into the board, standing waves at all kinds of angles. We can have all kinds of standing waves inside that box. Okay. So what we're going to do is focus on one of those standing waves. Each of those standing waves is called a mode of oscillation. So each electromagnetic standing wave or mode of frequency f okay, so you can imagine that these different standing waves will oscillate at different frequencies. So the standing waves that have just a few lumps will be oscillating slowly. Standing waves with many lumps between them will be oscillating very quickly. So let's pick just one of those standing waves, say this one right over here. That standing wave or mode oscillates with a certain frequency f, and it oscillates harmonically. Okay, it oscillates harmonically in this sense. If I pick any point on that standing wave, it goes down and up, down and up, down and up, like this, harmonically, in the same way as in exactly the same way as our ball inside the bowl. If we look at the x projection of that ball, it's just going back and forth on that x-axis harmonically. The word is harmonic. That's a special kind of vibration, a very special kind of vibration. That's very simple. Okay, and so any point on that wave oscillates harmonically. The entire mode oscillates harmonically. It's this thing which oscillates harmonically in the same way that this is a thing oscillating harmonically. So what can you tell me about the quantum nature of that thing which is oscillating harmonically? There's a probability involved, right? What can you tell me about its energies? Energy. Only discrete allowed energies. Okay? So in exactly the same way, there will only be discrete allowed energies. So it's discrete. So the total energy in any one of those modes, in particular a mode of frequency f, the energy in that mode is is this. So if we look back at our picture, if we look back at our picture here, the energy in that mode can be either this, or this, or this, or this, or this. So to pick any one of these, what I do is I just go 1/2 HF, the 0 point energy, and I add an integer number of HFs. So if I add 1, 2, 3 HFs, I mean this amount of energy. If I add 1 HF, I mean this amount of energy. If there's no HFs, I mean this amount of energy. Okay, so where n is an integer. What do you think that n means physically? What? Yeah, it's the energy level. So it tells me which energy level. This is n equals 1, 2, 3, 4. But physically, inside the box, what's inside the box when n is 5? Right? Number of photons. Right. It's the number of photons. So if I have an electromagnetic standing wave like this, which is oscillating with some frequency f, classically, so it's a classical wave, I've got this standing wave oscillating with some frequency f, the energy quantum mechanically is given by this, where n is some integer. And n tells me quantum mechanically how many photons there are present. So when I say the energy, when n is equal to 5, say, the amount of energy is 5 HF plus 1/2 HF, 5.5 HF. That's how much energy is in that mode. And what it's saying is there are 5 photons. There are 5 photons jiggling back and forth, making up that standing wave. So classically, when you think about the energy of a wave, how is the energy related to the amplitude? If the amplitude goes up, if the amplitude of a wave has gone up, the energy has gone up, right? So if I have some water wave in the water, if it has a low amplitude, it means there's only a little bit of energy in it. Okay, but if I splash in that water like crazy, give it lots of amplitude, then it's got lots of energy. And as the frequency goes up, the energy goes up too, right? So the energy of each one of those 5 photons is H times F. If it's a red photon, it's maybe not so much energy. If it's a blue photon, it's more energy. Okay, so so that's it. So this is quantum field theory. Now you guys can do quantum field theory. Yeah. Absolutely. So this is number of photons. And yeah, so when n is equal to 0, we still have an energy of 1/2 HF in the box. Right. Yeah, so what type of energy? Well, this is basically, there's sort of a Heisenberg uncertainty principle for electric and magnetic fields. Just like you have Heisenberg uncertainty for delta x, delta p is greater than or equal to h over 4 pi, there's a Heisenberg uncertainty connecting the electric and magnetic fields. Okay, so you can't have exactly 0 electric and exactly 0 magnetic. There's some uncertainty in these electric and magnetic fields in space. So there's fluctuations. Sorry? Yeah, so there's always at least this kind of 0 point fluctuation of the electromagnetic field. So that would be the terminology, 0 point fluctuation of the electromagnetic field. And it just represents classically this sort of random kind of jiggling of electric and magnetic, like the presence of random fluctuations of electric and magnetic field. Okay, and so do you believe that? Do you believe that inside a box like this, there is this stuff happening? Can we measure it or use it? Excellent question. We can do both. Okay, so here's how we measure it. This is one of the most amazing experiments that emerged in first of all, it was a theoretical prediction. So early on in quantum field theory, so 1930s or so, a guy called Casimir was thinking about this sort of stuff. And he looked at that and said, asked exactly the same question. So what if n is equal to 0? What does that mean? Well, so here's the experiment that he thought of. If I take two metal plates like this, and I put them, parallel to each other, and these are ideal conditions. So it's a perfect vacuum. It's pitch black. All the light has been removed. It's at zero temperature, all that stuff. Okay, so there's nothing. There's nothing but two plates, and they're hanging from little silk threads like this. Do you expect anything to happen? What do you expect that might happen? Yeah. So roughly speaking, okay, so what happens exactly is there is a force of attraction between these plates. Now normally you would think, well, sure, there's a force of attraction. If I have one plate that's say positively charged and one plate negatively charged, then yeah, there'll be an electrostatic attraction. But what I'm saying here is that you have neutralized both of these plates. There is zero net charge on all those plates. So electrostatic forces do not exist. Okay? And yet there is still a force of attraction between these plates. Okay? And so basically what's going on here is then there's a number of ways of looking at this. So one way is between these plates here. These are electromagnetic waves can reflect off of metal plates. Okay, so they're like mirrors, or just imagine they're mirrors. Okay, so inside here, I can have waves moving back and forth. Okay, but because they're bound waves, that means what kind of waves are we talking about? Standing waves. We've got one moving to the right, one moving to the left, they add up and make standing waves. And so there will only be certain allowed standing waves. Okay, so here's one standing wave. Here's the next standing wave, here's the next one, and so on and so forth. Okay, so there are these standing waves. And associated with each one of those standing waves is this 1/2 HF. Okay, so I've removed all the photons. There are no photons in here, and yet there is still this zero point energy. 1/2 HF for say that first mode plus 1/2 HF for that second mode. Plus and so on. Okay, so there's actually a bit of energy in there. Okay, so that's a good question. That's right. So according to this, now I'll get back to that in a second. According to this, the answer to this is just infinite. Infinite. There's an infinite amount of energy between those plates. That's a bit of a problem. Because if that were true, then the amount of warping of space-time would be very, very large, and this is happening everywhere in space, and the entire universe would collapse into, like, you know, this whatever, black hole. Okay, so that ain't happening. So this is actually an interesting problem. Okay, there is a solution to this problem. But anyway, so let me just point out. So in between the plates, we have that happening. Outside the plates, there's a plate here, sure, but there's no plates out here. So these zero-point fluctuations, these waves, these zero-point waves, whatever you call them, there's no restrictions on them. Here there was a restriction because it's bound. Here there's no restriction because it's not bound. So basically all vibrations are possible out here. Okay? So the situation is a little bit like this. If I have two boats and they're in the water like this, and we're in like choppy seas, wind, and all that stuff. Okay, then what we've got is waves splashing into the boat here, waves splashing into the boat here. There's all kinds of wave activity out here, and ignoring everything else, that wave activity exerts a force this way, pushing the boat this way. If there were no other boat here, then we would have the same amount of wave activity on this side, equal forces, and it would just kind of sit there. It would just kind of jiggle around, but sit there. Okay. And similarly here, we've got jiggling of waves out here, which exert a force on this side of this boat. Okay, but between the two, there's a wind shadow. Okay, and so there's fewer waves in here. There's less wave activity inside here, so there's less force this way. So what happens to the two boats over time? They crash into each other. So if you have two boats out on the open sea, you have to put like a brace between them or they're just going to crash together. Okay, so there's a force, a net force between them. So same thing is happening here. There's tons of wave activity out here, this zero-point fluctuation, and tons of wave activity out here. Normally, if you just have one plate, it just sits there. But because you have two plates, you're restricting. You're not allowed to do any kind of wave vibration. So there's less wave activity inside, and there's a net force pushing them together. And you can actually measure that net force. The prediction is that net force goes like 1/1 the distance between them to the power of 4. So as they get closer together, the force of attraction grows very rapidly, like a 1 over distance to the 4. Okay, so if I reduce the distance by a factor of 2, 2 times 2 is 4, times 2 is 8, times 2 times 16, the force increases by a factor of 16. Okay, and so this was predicted a long time ago in the 1930s, and measurements were made, I'm not exactly sure when, but in the 1990s, super accurate measurements were made, which measured exactly this, and quantum mechanics predicts exactly that factor, and they were measured. And this has important effects when we're dealing with nanotechnology. Nanotechnology means we've reached the point where we can manipulate things at nanoscales. Okay, that's like at basically atomic scales. So at atomic scales, we have some silicon substrate like this, some material, and we want to build something like this, which is some objects. We're building objects. Okay, and so basically we have one plate over here next to another plate, which is this ground plate with some distance between them. Well, there's a Casimir force attracting these plates. And what happens is everything just gets gummed up. And so you have to find some way to overcome this Casimir force problem or use it to your advantage. And that's your job, is to figure out ways to use it to your advantage. Okay, we have clever people to try to do that. Okay, so what about what? Oh, all right. So this infinity here, you're worried about that infinity.
Yeah. So infinity versus infinity, you still got 0.
Well, infinity minus infinity, what is that?
I don't know. It's not a definite thing. So infinity minus infinity is anything.
Okay. This occurs very frequently in physics, where you do infinity minus infinity, and you make it make sense. Okay. But here's another way to make sense of this. Okay. And since we only have 5 minutes, let me just tell you this just quickly. So what is this zero-point energy between these plates? So I said it's 1/2 HF1 plus 1/2 HF2, all that kind of stuff. Okay. So it's 1/2 HF1 plus 1/2 HF2, and so on. These frequencies, how do they increase? So here's the standing wave, this one. And then here's the next standing wave. And here's the next standing wave. Okay, so I'm labeling the standing waves 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. If this vibrates at some frequency, F0, say, how rapidly does this second one vibrate? Twice F0. How rapidly does the third one oscillate? Okay, so these frequencies are proportional to just the integers. Okay, so what this is this is some constant, 1/2 HF and some factors involving C and all that stuff, times, so once some finite constant times 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 and so on. Infinity factorial is 1 times 2 times 3. So we're just adding these up. But it still looks big, right? This is just infinity, right? Now, it actually turns out that this number here, using some tricky math, you can convince yourself that this number is negative 1 over 12. Oh, I love math. Math rules. Do we have time to show you how? Okay. Okay, so let's suppose that we had, let's consider this. What is 1 over 1 minus x? Let's do longhand division. Okay, how do I do this? What do I start with? 1 times this is 1 minus x. I subtract this, what do I get? Okay, what do I put here? plus x. X times this is x minus x squared. What's the remainder? What's here? And so on. Okay, so this is 1 plus x squared plus x cubed, etc. Okay, let's see if this works. Let's see if this. So what we've found is two ways of representing a function. Okay, so this is one way of representing that function. This is another way. And so let's try putting in x equal to 1/2. Okay, on the left-hand side, what do we get? On the right-hand side, what do we get? We get 1 plus 1/2 plus 1/2 squared is 1/2 cubed, etc. Let's add all those numbers up, see if this works. What we take is 1, okay, plus 1/2. 1/2 is this, okay, plus 1/4, that means 1/2 of this, plus 1/8, which is 1/2 of what remains, and so on and so forth. So if I add this all up, I get, this is 0, 1, 2, I get 2. So that's right. Okay, so we're happy with that, right? This is called an infinite series. Okay, now let's suppose that we try x equals 2 in there. What's the left-hand side? When x is 2, we get what? Minus 1. Okay, let's try 1 plus x plus and so on. Plug in x equals 2 into that. What do we get? 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus 2. Okay. So now let's suppose that you were given this thing. You had no idea where this came from. But someone gave you that and said, what is that equal to? You would say, oh, well, that's just infinity. Except it's what? But it's negative 1, right? That's right. That's right. So the point here is, okay, let's look at along the x-axis. We know that this thing has a problem at x equals 1, right? Because 1 over 1 minus 1 is 1 over 0 is infinity, right? So that's 0. We know it has a problem here at x equals 1. And that's called a singularity. Okay? And so what we have done is, in writing this thing, 1 over 1 minus x, this 1 over 1 minus x is valid everywhere along the x-axis, except at that point. It's valid both for x less than 1 and for x bigger than 1. Works everywhere except at that point. Okay? Now what we've done is we've taken that function and we've written it in a different way. We've written it as this infinite series. As you're pointing out, the infinite series is valid only on a circle. Well, only in this range from minus 1 to plus 1. Okay, so if you plug in a number, x, that's between minus 1 and plus 1, this formula will give you the right answer. But that formula is not valid outside of here. Okay, it'll give you the wrong answer. Okay, so this is called a series representation, and it has a certain range of validity. This is the original function. Okay, so what physicists do is they say, I see that series 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4, and so on. It's just obviously infinite. But maybe it's a similar situation like this. Maybe what we're dealing with is a series expansion of some function that really is well defined, okay? But it's just being evaluated outside of its range of validity. So let's work backwards and try to find a function that is sort of defined everywhere, well defined everywhere, whose series expansion looks like this. Okay? And it turns out that such a thing exists, and it's called the Riemann zeta function. Okay, and the Riemann zeta function And the way you do this, this is where complex numbers comes in very powerful, okay? So the Riemann zeta function is similarly ill-defined at 1. Okay, it has a singularity there. Okay, but it's well-defined, so Riemann zeta function. So it's zeta as a function of z. And z is, I can let z be a real number, like x, so I can put in a real number in there, and it'll be well-defined. I can also put in imaginary numbers or complex numbers in general. So here's a complex number. Okay, so I'm going to have an x and a y axis here. This complex number is x plus iy, which I'll just call z. That complex number z I could stick in there, and I would have a well-defined function here. The function would be well-defined at that point. Okay? So I don't want to get into all the details and so on, but basically at the end of the day, if you look at that, if you look at this this series here, it's basically the Riemann zeta function being evaluated at a certain point. That's and the series expansion of this function is invalid at that point. But you know what the Riemann zeta function is, and it's actually and you can actually evaluate it, and it turns out to be -1/12. Okay, and then what you do is you say you know what this constant is. It's just 1/2 h times 1/(speed of light) or whatever. Okay, so there's some simple constant here, times this -1/12. Okay, that's the energy, and then these frequencies depend upon the size of the box. So your final expression for the energy inside the box, first of all, it's finite. It's not infinite. Okay. Secondly, it's negative. Thirdly, it depends upon the size of the box. Okay, and so it looks something like this: the zero point energy inside the box is something like negative some trivial constant, whatever, who cares, divided by 1/length, is it length cubed? Let's call it d. D is the separation between the plates. I think it's 1/d³. If I take, okay, what is energy? Energy is force times distance, right? Okay, so what I want is, energy divided by distance is force. So yeah, so I think this is right. So it looks like that. Okay, so if I take that energy, what I notice is, first of all, it's negative. But if I make the plate separation smaller, what does this thing become? Bigger. Okay, so it becomes more negative. Okay, so the energy between the plates becomes more negative. So it reduces as you bring those plates together. Things like to go to minimum energy, and so there's an attractive force associated with that tendency to lower energy. Okay? Isn't that amazing? That is so cool. The power of mathematics. Yeah. Oh, it's just, I mean, you have negative energy in the hydrogen atom, right? The hydrogen atom, you know, the potential energy looks like it's minus ke² / r, right? So the potential energy is negative, and the kinetic energy is positive, but the energy levels of the hydrogen atom are all below zero, right? So all of the bound state energies are negative. So it's not a problem having negative. But this one over here, so that's a good question. Is this an absolute energy or just a relative energy? Could we add an arbitrary constant to that? What do you think, Stefan? I would say that this is an absolute energy. Oh, sorry. No, I don't want to say that. Okay. Yeah. Okay, let me think about that one too. You guys go for lunch. Remember that we have the IQC people here, so let's be welcoming to them. So let's head out there.